And welcome to Dap Happy, episode 8. I'm your host, John, and joining me this week is my fellow compadre in the communications department, Ian. How's it going, Ian?
Hello, John. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on. First time guest.
You are so awesome.
Oh, my gosh. What is this? Where have you been collecting these samples?
You're hearing? You got to hear this.
You are so awesome. Oh.
It's so accurate as well.
I know. Great. I've got them out in front of me, so we're gonna try and do some sound effects today. So we've just been running through the news, and we basically ran out of paper because there's been so much news this week. Kind of hard to know where to start, really. I guess should we start at least with some structure and 5 years of Ethereum? I guess that's a
Let's kick off with Ethereum because it's an important week for an important protocol for our business as well. So yeah, let's talk about ETH and what they're doing. Yeah.
So I've been looking at some numbers, as I tend to do, doing an article, a video. And one of the interesting things, I think is something, you know, we've been looking at for a long time is ETH. And there's lots of other blockchains out there. We cover, what is it now, 13 with more to come. And really, we've seen lots of kind of competition, and we've had Cardano kind of do its mainnet this week. So there's more competition to come for Ethereum. But for the last year, at least, and certainly the last 6 months, it really seems surprising, really, that this kind of once unloved sort of blockchain, as I think it kind of was a couple of years ago, is just kind of powering ahead. It's just like, yeah, there's all these other ones out there. There's your EOSes and your Trons, and there's all these other lovely shiny ones coming in the future. But Ethereum is in. It couldn't have timed it better for its fifth year birthday party, could it?
I know, right? In time with the DeFi movement as well, and what's happening, it just seems so coincidental that all this is happening. But yeah, I think it's kind of definitely played off its first mover advantage. And interestingly as well, obviously we work in the comms department. Ethereum has been not like massively open with their PR and things like that. They don't spend a ton of money on it. They just kind of gain notoriety from being early in the game and having quite an, I guess Vitalik's pretty transparent and open as well, which helps. So yeah,
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, compared to Bitcoin, you have like an anonymous founder who obviously never really said anything past the initial thing. And there's some advantages of that because, you know, he can't say stupid things or do stupid things. But equally, there's no real figurehead. And Vitalik is kind of interesting in the sense that he doesn't say much. But so when he does say things, people are kind of interested. And I just listened to a podcast with him actually, and he was and it is striking how I'm not saying I agree with him on everything, his approach, but he has a very clear vision on what he wants. And obviously, you know, it was his vision that kicked the whole thing off in the first place. And I think that is kind of, you know, the best of both worlds when you have someone who clearly is super intelligent, has a very strong idea about what he wants to do and what he doesn't want to do, isn't in total control. So, you know, people can disagree with him and do other things. But I think that's quite helpful to have that kind of, you know, sensible kind of figurehead.
Yeah, definitely. And I think people kind of buy into his ethos and his ideas, and that's the angle he takes, isn't it? It's like I'm gonna tell the truth, and I'm gonna talk about what I want to achieve, and whoever wants to come along for the ride, like jump on board, basically. And you see those ETH maximalists and other people. But yeah, I mean, it's been a pretty incredible journey in such a short amount of time as well. What is it? Five years and.
Round of applause. Round of applause for
I mean, I don't know. Did you think, John, maybe four years ago that we would be sitting here talking about Ethereum as the kind of backbone of this industry? I mean, was that in your mind back then?
Well, I'll let you in on a secret. 4 years ago, I didn't know about Ethereum. No, I didn't have a clue at all. So yeah, I've only been in blockchain for 2.5 years. So I'm much later on. I mean, I knew about Bitcoin, back from back in the day. But coming at it from a games perspective, I wouldn't care about Bitcoin as a financial mechanism. I would only be interested in a blockchain that can run games. So I've only ever been interested in smart contract blockchain. So that's been my thing. I do think, you know, as I say, it's interesting timing that we've literally for the last kind of 6 weeks, 2 months, we've had this massive explosion of what's going on with DeFi, although that's been happening, really for the last 6 months, really actually since MakerDAO went multi-collateral. That I see that as the starting point.
Yeah, that was like November, right? Last year, yeah.
A lot of things picked up after that, and it just happened that we have this particular kind of asset bubble going on. And obviously that's reflected in the, you know, I think for the first time, really, that I've been around, we've seen Ethereum, kind of positivity in the Ethereum space generally driving the price of ETH, and then that's driven the price of all other cryptocurrencies. Some people might find that controversial. I don't know. I think you have to be careful always with causation and correlation. But to me, it seems that either it's just like the butterfly effect that something random's happened and the price of ETH has gone up first. But it seems like to me the price of ETH kind of went up first, and then that drove everything. Normally, it's been the price of Bitcoin has driven everything. So I think that's kind of an interesting kind of dynamic.
Shifting dynamics slightly, definitely. I also think it's super interesting how, like, back in 17, you saw a lot of people rushing in, which was driving volume and users. But more recently, we're seeing a different sort of trend. Like, the price of ETH hasn't been going up. It's going up, but it's not going up dramatically like it did in 17, where it jumped up like almost $1,000. And maybe a lot of people this week as well have kind of been watching the prices, rubbing their hands together, thinking this might happen. But personally, I can't see that happening again.
That's a really good point. And I think kind of what we've learned from kind of end of 2017, early 2018, was that ridiculous kind of speculative bubble. And I think people, when I got into the space, people were like, oh, you know, Bitcoin's hit like 20,000, it's gone down again, but, you know, we'll be back up to 20,000 soon. And clearly we've seen Bitcoin, not being able to maintain the $10,000. Well, you know, there's no reason it should maintain $10,000. That's just like a psychological anchor point that we think about. But I think we've basically kind of come to a different scenario where the price of Bitcoin will be just a speculative thing that the people who love Bitcoin will go for. That's fine. And maybe you get some institutions coming in, but they're not going to care about the price of Bitcoin if the price of Bitcoin stays at $10,000, because that's the point of these things to degrees, they kind of go up. But I think with Ethereum now, the focus has shifted. I mean, maybe this is me. I wouldn't say I'm a maximalist on that point, but I guess at that radar in general, our confirmation bias is we think dApps are really interesting. So we look at everything through the lens of dApps are kind of more, in a sense, more important than the blockchain. The activity around dApps is more interesting than just having a blockchain that kind of plods along and creates blocks every so often. You know, you have to have some reason for it, don't you?
Yeah, it gives it a tangible reason to exist. Like every kind of, well, Ethereum is basically what? An operating system. And in order for any operating
system. Computer. Although apparently we don't use that phrase anymore. So.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, basically. Yeah, but every kind of operating system had its like shining star, didn't it? That drove adoption. Like in with the internet, it was basically what? Pirated music, pornography, and those kind of things drove masses of people into the internet. So with Ethereum, the dApps have created a reason for people to interact with Ethereum. Otherwise, what else would they be doing? Just buying tokens, selling tokens, and it would be like Bitcoin.
It is interesting. So I was looking back at the data, and this is kind of the article I'm doing, and looking at, if you just look at the transactions on the Ethereum blockchain, it's quite striking that obviously the biggest spike so far was in early 2018 when the price was at the highest. And obviously, why would that drive transactions on the Ethereum blockchain? Well, everyone's trading because they think the price is going to go higher, and then they're all trading out again because the price has collapsed. And then what's interesting is the price totally falls away, and we're like 75% down from the all-time high. But if you look at transactions again, at some point in the next week probably, or the next kind of month, we're going to hit an all-time transaction high. So that's interesting. So I know we use this term flipping kind of a lot, but I see it as a flipping, because previously we had the transactions being driven by price speculation, and that drove transactions. Price goes away, but transactions have always stayed fairly high. They've not dropped away like price has, and now we see transactions going to hit an all-time high, driven by dApp activity, specifically DeFi dApps, which have a certain amount of speculation into them, certainly. But that's not driven the price in the same way. It's driven it at a small amount, so we're up like whatever, we're up 30%, 40%.
Yeah, 30%. Yeah.
But we've seen this flipping from speculation driving transaction volume to transaction volume now, for the first time, I would argue again, starting to drive price, but driving price in a non-speculative manner. So that's quite nice to see. I don't expect to see Ethereum value at $1,000. Maybe it will be. I probably don't think it will be. But we'd expect to see, as more people are using these dApps, then some of that value will accrue to the ETH token because people are using it, and there will be some speculation around that as well. And I find that level is kind of quite quite positive, I think. And I think that kind of plays out to what we think at that radar, which is you know, I guess I don't know if we go into a fat thesis or a thin thesis. I guess I'm a Goldilocks in between kind of thesis. I kind of think you need a strong blockchain price because that's the security model. But people are using the DApps, and that's kind of, you know, at some point the blockchain becomes a commodity, I suppose. So I guess I'm more of a thin.
It's logic. I think I'd agree. I tend to definitely agree with everything you just said. It's very logical to make those conclusions, I think. And when you look at the data as well in regards to transactions, then you see that what you're saying is absolutely accurate. And that, yeah, I mean, what we talk about often is the day that, you know, DApp activity starts driving token value. And that's something a bit different, isn't it? Where the DApp activity is actually adding serious, tangible value to the blockchain. And it makes perfect sense that that's going to start occurring right now. As you said, with DeFi DApps and that level of, there is some level of speculation there. You know, it's not a... It's a different entity, isn't it? So I can see the next sort of 1 year, 2 years being really interesting in regards to how DApp activity affects token price, if at all.
I think we've definitely moved into an era where we can start. I mean, still, I'd say it's very small. I was looking at some of the volumes, the value going into DeFi DApps, or the value going into the top 10 DeFi DApps I was looking at, and then the value of just ETH trading, and it's still very, it's like a couple of percent. It's still, not strong. But I guess the other interesting thing is, and I guess, you know, whoever's planning ETH's birthday party done it very well. Because the other thing that interesting that happened was the value of the ERC20 tokens, so the value of the tokens running on the Ethereum blockchain altogether, their market cap, if you add them all up, became bigger than the market cap of ETH.
Right. So the applications running on top are now more valuable.
So that's kind of interesting. That was why people were debating this whole kind of fat thin protocol thesis. But, you know, in a more holistic way, you would kind of go, you wouldn't, I guess if it went like 90%, 10%, that'd be a bit of a problem. But if it's like roughly 50-50, and you can treat the whole thing, if you treat ETH and all the ERC20 tokens, then that's like 20% of the cryptocurrency kind of total value now, and I think that's only going to rise. So I think that's just another. I would just, without being too kind of getting to, you know, technical analysis, which I don't really believe, to be honest. I just say, in general, you have a positive thing that hasn't happened before, and whether you know the price of the ERC20 tokens will continue to rise, probably will, because more will be launching. I think it just goes to prove that Ethereum has been successful. I'm not saying it's going to be successful, the most successful blockchain in future. I mean, obviously, you know, Cardano launched this week, a long way to go. They're already talking, you know, obviously their CEO who was the originally
talking a big game, right?
Yeah, but he was originally the CEO of Ethereum as well until he fell out with them. So Charles Hodgkinson.
I just think with Cardano, like, it's interesting because they were such a, back in 2017-18, they were right there next to Ethereum, Bitcoin. They were involved in all the conversations you saw. They were there. And on paper, it looked brilliant and it looked like a very scalable solution, and it looked good and it looked like a major competitor. And then we fast forward like 2.5-3 years, and I really haven't heard a great deal about Cardano. I keep looking at my token to see if it's gone up at all. And it's kind of something I invested in back then. But this has come as a sort of, it's great to see, but as I think we both will say, his statement is a bit wild, let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, so the statement we're particularly talking about is he says, you know, the mainnet's gone live. They've still not got smart contracts on it yet, so it's still very early stages. And the one thing you would say is, you know, they have taken their time and built, I think they're building out a really great technical solution. And, you know, they're not worried about, you know, getting out there quickly like some other blockchains, you know, would be. They're going to do a good job. But he was saying, he's saying this time next year we'll have thousands of dApps running on the system. So we were just looking at, you know, the moment on Ethereum, Dapp Radar only tracks still less than 2,000 dApps. And the majority of those don't have any users because obviously it's been going for 5 years. So if you launch something 5 years ago and it didn't work out, it's still potentially, we're still tracking the smart contracts. So if you look at EOS and Tron, whatever you think about those projects, they technically have been kind of broadly successful. They have less than 700, 800 kind of dApps on there. So to have thousands of dApps, I'm not saying it won't be the case for Cardano, but that would be... If you assume thousands of dApps means 2,000 dApps, that would make it kind of as successful as EOS with Ethereum in a year. So I think that's pushing it a little bit. but, you know.
Definitely. When, because of what we do, obviously, for a living, we know the numbers that we work with. And as you say, we're at like the number of 3,500 across 13 blockchains. And there's many other blockchains out there that we're not tracking. So even I think some of our competitors might be tracking 4,500 or whatever. But for him to come out and say thousands, I mean, obviously, the big question is quality over quantity. He can, maybe there can be thousands of dApps on there. But as we just said, and you rightly say, there only a few of them will flourish. I guess it's kind of throw enough mud at the wall so some of it sticks. But it's an interesting statement. I think it's only going to be beneficial for the dApp ecosystem for more high quality dApps to come in. And Cardano is a little bit different, isn't it? The way it operates, its architecture is different, isn't it? In terms of it's got.
I'm not that technical. I mean, I think, but they all are, aren't they? I mean, I've just been writing down actually. I mean, I'm missing out loads here, but like other sort of blockchains that you could run dApps on. Yeah, we've got things like the Hedera hash graph is kind of been out for a while. We've had Algorand, which has been out for a while. We've got coming. We've got a lot of people talking about now Avalanche. We've got Flow coming from the CryptoKitties people, which is specifically focused on sort of games and consumer dApps. We've got kind of Near, we've got Definity, we've got Polkadot and Cosmos, which are slightly different because they're kind of meta chain sort of thing. But it's just, you know, and I'm sure if we really delve down into it, there'd be like another
million of them, I'm sure, yes. I mean,
and so for me, the question is, it's never been a question of can I raise enough money? Can I get some smart people together, raise enough money, make a blockchain that does something that we've never seen before? You know, I mean, that's not easy, but it's not difficult. The difficult bit is getting the developers. And what we've seen is Ethereum is actually not a great blockchain. I was listening to another podcast from Trail of Bits, who do audits. And it was scary how bad the underlying security of basic things like the Solidity programming language is. Just like, it's just kind of broken. I mean, it's just like there's loads of known bugs in the compiler, obviously it's decentralized, so no one's enforcing anything, and most developers haven't got a clue about security. So, you know, all these hacks and things we see, these vulnerabilities, you know, Ethereum is really super bad for that. You know, I mean, it's just like, you know, you probably couldn't make a worse system if you tried. So it's not perfect by any means, but just developers know what's going on with it. There's a massive ecosystem, and now I guess the most important thing is there's billions of dollars worth of these ERC tokens locked into this system. So if you're going to be successful, you have to attract a bunch of developers, or find a new bunch of developers who are interested in blockchain and have never, you know, are happy to move to your new blockchain. And then you have to get billions of dollars of money from somewhere to lock into your system to make the whole thing kind of work. So I'm coming to the conclusion that I think over time, what we'll see for Ethereum is Ethereum will be just this just very strong in this decentralized finance space, because that's where the value is being locked in, and people aren't going to be wanting to move value around. I think some of the ETH maximalists would also, you know, they see value being sucked from Bitcoin with things like wrapped Bitcoin and all these other protocols. Yeah, that will, because if you've got Bitcoin at the moment, what can you do with it? The price is not going to double. It doesn't seem like. So people are going to be taking that Bitcoin value, sticking it in ETH tokens, because you can bridge that fairly easily. I think that does provide a massive opportunity for the more consumer faced stuff, for the games, for other social dApps and things like that. I don't think they're priced out of Ethereum at the moment because of gas fees.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, they can't really operate successfully there.
Gaming's dead on Ethereum.
It's sad. It's very sad.
It's not totally dead, but what I think what we're seeing is there's certain types of interaction that you can do, and that's gaming on Ethereum will have to be focused on high value NFTs, because that's the new way you can pay $5 gas fees or whatever.
If you're doing a big transaction, it's not such a hit, but when you're doing something very small, it's such a waste. But what we've seen as a result is other blockchains sort of raising their heads up and finding an opportunity there as well. Ones that were already good in the games category, like EOS, like Tron, that are already kind of showing.
I do think something like Flow. So I was about to say, you know, something that we particularly hit is something like CryptoKitties, because the CryptoKitties is you're breeding all the time. Most of the things you breed are worthless. So you don't pay gas fee on something that's worthless. So they're taking CryptoKitties to the new Flow chain, which is from Dapper Labs, which is launching, I think, fairly soon. They've got some other things going on there. They announced a really odd announcement. They're doing Dr. Seuss collectibles, which is kind of like...
Yeah, I saw that. What the hell is that? Very weird choice of collectibles, right?
But apparently the Dr. Seuss people came to them. So it's kind of, I think that's the way around it. And the thing is, in some ways, it's clever. Everyone likes Dr. Seuss. You know, I like Dr. Seuss. I start reading Dr. Seuss to my kids. So there's that appeal. But just collectibles, I don't know if it's strong enough to just... If they did something, there was some sort of game around it. Anyway, that's by the by. But I do think something like Flow has an opportunity to take some of the game, to get some of the games over there.
If they do a good job as the native blockchain for crypto, then I think perhaps that'll create a case study where other dApp game projects will think, well, you know what, this is definitely the one that's tailored just for what we need.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there is a big gap there, so we'll see. Moving on, actually, a nice segue. Didn't plan this at all. but talking about other blockchains, so we have the Wax blockchain, which is a kind of a version of EOS. It uses the EOS IO SDK, and it's interesting that they, the background of the founders there is games, and they always kind of position themselves as a gaming kind of blockchain that hasn't quite paid off yet. They've got a couple of games on them, but not particularly done anything.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not. They position that way, but you don't see the produce, as it were. Like, it's not there yet, is it?
But what we have seen, and definitely where it's happening for Wax, is collectibles. So they did this Garbage Pail Kid kind of first kind of drop. When was it? But a couple of months ago now, and that was like super successful. I think not millions of dollars. I think it did about $250,000 in terms of sales and trading. But that was a bit of a surprise, I think.
Definitely,
for everyone.
For them, I think the idea was solid, like, and what they're bringing to the table. And I think, at the beginning, we were saying like their background is games, and I always find it interesting that Quigley, his background was with Disney.
Do you be a bit more formal, William Quigley,
sorry,
the CEO?
William Quigley, the CEO of Wax. His background, my pal Quigley. His background is Disney, so. Two things there. His obviously they run a tight ship. So in terms of what they do at Wax, I find that their operations are really tight. But with Quigley, I think that it's interesting with his ties with Disney. There's no way he didn't, you don't leave Disney and disavow all those contacts you made and, get rid of them all. So interesting things, I believe, for the Wax blockchain, given their sort of network of contacts and things. And we see that with Garbage Pail Kids. That's a big brand.
Well, it's not. No, it's not. No. I'm going to stop you there. It's not a big brand. It's like an interesting brand. It's very American.
It's very American.
I think it was a good...
Tops is a big brand, though, John, right?
No, Tops, the company, is a big company. I think it was a good... Garbage Pail Kids was quirky and had like an internet sort of meme-ness to it, I think. And I think it was like an ideal test case to see if anyone cared about this stuff. They did the first set, then he did the Tiger Exotic set or whatever it's called. And that was a smaller set of cards that sold out really quickly. And then they've announced they're doing this. They're doing a Street Fighter one. They've kind of done like weird teasers about Iron Man, so there's kind of people go back to your Disney thing, whether they're going to do some Marvel stuff. But the big thing this week was William Shatner, which is just like, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of the right generation to know him through Star Trek, but equally,
yeah. But is it a good thing that we know him or a bad thing that we know him? And to be honest, you made me laugh a lot yesterday, but we'll get to that with the photo.
So Star Trek is obviously still a big thing. It's not the biggest thing anymore compared to kind of things like, obviously Star Wars and Marvel and that sort of stuff. But there is a nostalgia to it. They've obviously done the remakes with Picard. So there is, I think, and the people who Shatner memorabilia, digital photos would appeal to are kind of, they're going to be older, so they're going to maybe a bit more, I think I'm maybe talking rubbish, they've got a bit more money to spend, that's right, but they're going to be a bit more into blockchains. I don't think that's right at all, is it?
Yeah, I was thinking about that yesterday. I was like, the demographic audience is about, what, touching 40 almost, like maybe 50.
Shatner, or older than that.
Yeah, it must be, like it's my mum and dad's, I don't know really.
Well, how old is he? 70s.
He's in his 70s. I was thinking about when I used to watch. So we were, when I sent it to our social media colleague yesterday, and I said to her, like, look, this guy, he's quite a big deal. And she's like, I don't know who he is. So Picard, I was saying, like, Picard might have been a better choice. But, I mean, I think they're playing it quite smart. Like you said, with the Garbage Pail Kids, it has a niche appeal almost. They know there's an audience there and that audience really kind of cares about that project and that product. So with Shatner, I think
it might not be a massive audience, but there is an audience and it will be guaranteed. And Shatner's got a pull factor and it will be another success for them, basically, rather than a gamble, perhaps. They think like that.
No, no, definitely, yeah. I do think the other thing, it's funny how we just call him Shatner. I picked you up on Quigley, but we can call Shatner the word. I think the other thing is he... So there is obviously a memorabilia thing that nothing to do with blockchain. And I think he's... Because he was so... he was like... You know, Star Trek was earlier than Star Wars, obviously, and Star Trek had the whole kind of Trekkie convention. So there's probably a reasonably large market for his real life memorabilia anyway, and he has encouraged that over the years. And I think that's with Garbage Pail, that was interesting because obviously people do in the real world collect these physical sticker cards. You know, even if you're only converting a small amount of that existing audience, there is an audience there who collects these things in real life, and now you're saying you can collect these things digitally as well. And I think the other thing interesting with Wax is, and why their approach is quite strategic, that every time you have a success, then people write, you know, articles saying this sold out in like, you know, I think the first one sold out in like 2 days, the next one sold out in within a day, Shatner sold out within 6 hours or something. So now, even if you're just someone who wants to make some money on the blockchain, which is basically everyone, you go, oh, Wax is doing a new collectible. So you try and get in there because you know you can spin it all off and make money. And what's interesting, I had a quick look at the Shatner stuff, and what they do with these collectibles is they sell them in packs. So I don't know about the Shatner one actually, but the other ones you paid $5 for a pack of 5 cards, or $20 for a pack of 30 cards. And what you found was that obviously when you buy the packs, you can open them and get the cards out, and then you can trade the cards. You know, and people want to collect sets. You know, you want to get the whole set, so you need to open the packs to get the sets. But actually, what happens, and this is I think what happens in the real world is, the most valuable things are the packs themselves. So now people are buying the packs, not opening the packs, and trying to resell the packs. So this is a really interesting kind of mechanic. I just got to think now Wax can kind of put anything out because people have made money on it before, so they're going to make money on it again. So just encourage more money. So it's kind of interesting.
With the packs, like I get how that works in the physical world. It's like you buy a pack, and if you keep it in excellent, you know, proper condition, then it's worth more in the long run. But with a digital pack, you lose that kind of that tangibility. You can't touch it and feel it. It doesn't get damaged, as it were. It just gets digitally passed around through sets of hands. I wonder if that might become a metric of kind of value later in time, where how many sets of hands has this card passed through? Maybe it's now worth less.
It's just
thinking out loud, really, about how it might evolve as a way of collection. And
I would say outside of collectibles, there is a more... There's always been this thing in games where people say, you know, if someone won, I mean, it's a cliche, but I will say, you know, if someone won some sort of esports tournament with this particular kind of character or weapon or something, and that can be provably traced, then that would have more value to it. Or someone was arguing the other day or something. I may have made this up because I'm a bit obsessed by Taylor Swift at the moment, the new album. But I think someone said something like, if Taylor Swift owned a crypto kitty, would it be worth more or something? It's kind of one of these weird, and you're like, of course it would.
Yeah, it would. Yeah,
I mean, quite how you prove Taylor Swift's wallet owned it, sort of thing. But if she said, I suppose she showed you the hash. But so actually, I was overly dismissive of your thing about collectibles. So it could be the case. But I think what's interesting about the packs is there's a fixed number of packs, and every time one's open, there's less, and because it's an irreversible step, you can't go back and create a pack. So I think that's why packs become like an internal currency to something that already has lots of layers of currencies. So.
I think it's super interesting to watch Wax and the way that they're developing and where they found success basically as well. And I always say quite openly, I do like their project. I think it's nice and tight. But
I think for me, what will be interesting, because I don't particularly care about the collectible side of things, although it's interesting financially, is once you've got users and once you've generated value, because you can only buy the packs with fiat currency. So you buy the packs with your credit card, and then you trade them for the Wax cryptocurrency. And obviously, you can like any cryptocurrency, you can cash out Wax through an exchange and get your fiat back out again. But basically, I think what happens is people trade people get the Wax for trading their items, and they keep the wax in there because they go, well, something else is going to come along that I might want to use the wax for. I don't want to keep coming in and out because, you know, you get the trading fees between fiat and crypto. So basically they're accumulating users and they're who are accumulating wax in the system. So you've, in a very small way compared to Ethereum and DeFi, with wax has building up users, building up value in the system. Can they then convert those into a more long-term serious project, such as a game, which is, I think, long-term what they've always wanted to do is do game stuff. So I wonder if this is the collectibles thing is a really smart way of building users, building scale, which is the hardest thing for any blockchain to do, and then the next things will come along. So hopefully
that's really logical, John. Definitely, you know, you build out the marketplace. I think in the future marketplaces will become completely integral to blockchain games, of course, like the whole asset trading and digital.
Well, I mean, this is another small data point. I'll probably get it wrong now. There was a data point about OpenSea, so the marketplace, Ethereum marketplace, and it had can I get this right, 20,000 wallets. I need to check this. Something like that, yeah.
Which marketplace?
OpenSea. I know it had a 2 in it. I know it had some zeros. I can't. It's not definitely more than 200. I'm trying to think. Last time I looked at the numbers on it, I can't find it. I think it's 20,000. Here we go. Yeah, 20,000 users. The lifetime. So that's pretty interesting. And I think what's interesting, actually, because they've been saying like Ethereum gas fees have kind of killed off gaming. What OpenSea now is having a lot of is kind of we've seen like a minor boom in kind of crypto art, and we're seeing obviously there's been these things for a while like Known Origin and Super Rare and Market. There's a few others anyway. But now we're seeing things like Nifty Gateway. They've been doing these two weekly drops that have been selling really well, and I just noticed on crypto Twitter. A lot of the people who were doing gaming, who are gaming people, are just kind of like, nothing to do, got loads of crypto, and it all started buying digital art.
But it makes sense for me, like in terms of, I can see all this puzzle fitting together in games like Crypto Voxels and those bigger virtual world games where people are collecting digital art to put inside their digital house on their digital piece of land. And I see that Ready Player One life evolving right in front of my eyes, basically. And I think the next decade, We're going to see that. And people are just trying to get in there early. And those people, like that red rectangle image, you saw that, right? This guy selling pixel red rectangle. And I think it was, can't even remember the value, a couple of thousand. Is that it? I mean, that's ridiculous. And it, to me, it just feels a bit crazy. Like, it's a bit crazy, but okay, cool. Let's see where this goes. That's, I think it's interesting from that point. I like the art side of things, as you know. Like, I think... I used to work with a lot of artists, and I think they are missing a trick somewhat. They could be making profits. They could be making revenue from these sites, and they don't even know about them, I think, at the moment. So.
Why probably artists should be a bit more aware of it is, I think the quality of art, and generally I would say, is pretty poor. So I'm going to say I'm an art snob or something. I don't know. I mean, I like the history of art a lot, but I don't like modern art. Or contemporary art, as we call it. You know, so I'm a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to art. I like figurative art, mainly painting you put on a wall. Anyway, I do think a lot of this art is quite generic digital sort of art. And, you know, some of it's clever, but I don't find much emotional attachment to it. Some of it I do. What is interesting is if you, on a lot of these marketplaces, is when you get secondary sales. So obviously the artist uploads their art, someone comes along and buys it. And then they own that art piece. It's an NFT. And then someone else can obviously come along and buy that for a higher or lower price. Doesn't matter. But the artist, in the smart contract that runs that, the original artist can be guaranteed like 5% or 10% of that trade. And I know in the traditional art world, there'd be movements towards that, but it's obviously pretty difficult to do. You can't enforce that in any way. If it's some Swedish, you know, some secretive Swiss bank selling stuff, you know, how does the artist know? Whereas obviously on a blockchain, the artist knows exactly because they've created an NFT they can track. So I think that will be interesting when the artist is part of the cycle.
Yeah, and the commission as well. Like, I was quite surprised on Super Rare to see that if an artist sells his image, say to me, for example, if I sell that, he then receives 5% on that sale that I do as well. So his income is everlasting from his hard work. And that is kind of why I find it super interesting, because having worked in creative industries, it's really difficult for artists and musicians to get paid overall. like it's always been a sticky point, like divvying up creative rights in music and things like that. It's always been difficult. And I wouldn't say blockchain solves the problem. It puts it onto a nice, easy database, but you know, the band are still going to argue about who wrote most of the song. You can't blockchain emotional decisions.
Well, no, but you can though, because what you would do is in the original contract, yeah, you know, they might retrospectively say, well, I was a bit hungover that day, and I should have had 10%. But basically, you know, it is a legal document that then sits on a bit of code, and the money comes in and it splits it out. So yeah, you could have arguments about it, but in some ways it makes things a bit cleaner. And I think the other good point you make is I think it's long term revenue for artists. So that's yeah, you do something well, and then hope, you know, you're kind of building up. I guess the other thing is artists, I guess, can be a temptation, and I think certainly at the moment for digital artists, they can churn this stuff out so quickly. They just go, I'll do one piece of art every day, and I can sell it. Whereas actually, what you want is your artist to go, I want to make obviously something brilliant that's great, and it's going to be so good that it's going to sell, keep selling for like 30 years. I'm going to make a bit of money. It's going to go up in price every time, and I'm going to create kind of scarcity in my art because I know that's going to drive the price, in future. You know, potentially, assuming blockchains are around, you know, these things might become, in 100 years, might be very valuable. You know, you can imagine if Picasso's family had 5% of every Picasso sale from, you know, they'd be billionaires, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I was just about to say that the way art works as well is sometimes a piece of art might not be actually considered to be great when it was first painted, for example. Like in the year that it was painted, maybe nobody cares. Maybe it's too futuristic, this and that. 50 years later, for example, somebody might see that image and think, wow, that's truly amazing. And it's got some...
It's Van Gogh, isn't it? I mean, Van Gogh never sold any art apart from to his brother and to pay off debts.
Maybe he wouldn't have cut his ear off if he was getting 5% on every resale. But it's an interesting topic, I think, overall, because from my perspective, I would love to see creative artists and creative people get paid for their works, because it's a horrible industry to be in, really. It's changing, but yeah, it is what it is. Hopefully it can...
Running out of time, haven't we got a competition?
Oh, yes. Oh, how smoothly we shifted into the... how smoothly we talked about collectibles. So there's a game, actually, a DAP game. Well, call it a game. It's collectibles / gaming. It's called So Rare. It's a football game, and it's basically, I think it's a couple of friends, it's been produced in France, the team are from France, and they've done a really great job of signing up some of the best teams on earth, basically, notable teams. You know, you're looking at English Premier League teams, Spanish La Liga, Italian Serie A teams. So basically the principles of the game is you build up 5 cards, you build a deck, and then you go to battle with another person who's got 5 cards, and if you've got the best players, you'll probably win the game. And blah, blah, blah. And you can buy players and you can sell players and you can do other things. So we're doing a competition, basically. There's a player, plays for Lazio, called Ciro Immobile. He's about to become the European Golden Boot holder. So he's a bit of a big deal. He's actually beating Ronaldo right now. And we'll be giving away a rare card of him, fundamentally. So all you have to do is go to DAP Radar. The blog post sits under special events. Click on that, sign up for So Rare, and you've automatically been entered to win that card. And there's only 39 of those cards in existence. And this guy's profile as a footballer is growing. So this card, as we were just talking about, may be worth some more money in the future.
Although he's not going to get 5% of it, because it's not digital art.
I kind of don't think he needs it with his 200 grand a week wages, but he might. That little 5%.
Cool. Good. Okay. Well, we'll put a link into the show notes to that as well. Excellent. Thank you very much, Ian. We've covered a lot of ground at high speed. Talk too far.
Yeah. Yeah. Good fun. Well, that's kind of our industry, isn't it? A lot of stuff happening at high speed. So yeah.
Yeah. Good. Lovely. Thanks. Thank you, listeners. If you've made it all the way through, you can find us on your podcast supplier or platform of choice. Every week we're kind of chewing up the world of dApps, which, is just like constantly amazing, constantly evolving. And can we keep track of it all? I don't know.
At least we've always got something to talk about, right?
Gracious. Yeah. But it's what we do at DAP Radar. So if you want to look at the data around these dApps, do come on and you can kind of see what is hot and what is not. But thanks for listening to this one, and hope to see you again next week.
Yeah, thanks, guys. All right, take care. Bye.